Welcome to Galaxy Brains, the weekly podcast from Galaxy Research. Yo, the market's steady ripping and it's going berserk. And I'm eloquent with speech, call me Hester Peirce. Enveloping the street with my blessed verse. I'm delving in the beat, dropping fire when I rap. Smoking liars on the track, burning pyres when I snap. Flipping tires cause I'm wired like the clock behind my back. Ticking higher every minute when I'm topping up my stack. See, I'm dripping it, future's infinite and we're living it. We're rolling deep inside the thick of it. And I'm serious, this time is different. These are the good old days and in the market now is the should hold phase, cause the movement is booming, every flower is blooming, every hour is special, every dip is disputed. Yo, I'm running out of haters who are ready to battle me, but you've gotta stay humble when your brain is in the galaxy. As always, I'm Alex Thorne, head of firmwide research at Galaxy Digital. Thank you for listening to Galaxy Brains. We have a great show for you today. SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce is our guest. We'll get into it deep with Commissioner Peirce about regulation, the SEC's positioning and views on things, and what it takes to promote and support innovation in America. We'll also check in with our good friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading to talk markets and macro. But before we get to all of that, I remind you to please refer to the link to the disclaimer in the podcast notes and note that none of the information in this podcast constitutes investment advice or an offer, recommendation, or solicitation by Galaxy Digital or any of its affiliates to buy or sell any securities. We have a lot to talk about on this episode. I know you're going to like it in the market. We are absolutely ripping. It is a new day in Bitcoin markets. Let's get right into it with our friend Bimnet. Let's go now to our friend Bimnet Abibi from Galaxy Trading. As always, Bimnet, welcome to Galaxy Brains.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, we are in the midst of a historic move right now, truly. I mean, Bitcoin's up about 20% in 3 days alone. You can see over my shoulder, we're in the mid 62,000.
63K, let's call it.
Apparently, the block clock is a little bit behind.
It's a little delayed at 63K here.
I mean, this is Mike Novogratz, the CEO of Galaxy, tweeted this morning that we're effectively in price discovery now. I'm assuming he means that's because, you know, we weren't really above this level in 21 for more than a day or two or a couple of days. What are your takeaways from what you're seeing in the market?
I think this is a revaluation of the entire space in its entirety. I think folks are seeing the dramatic flow figures from the Bitcoin ETFs, and they're just extrapolating that forward. And when you start to extrapolate that forward on an asset that has supply that is going to be shrinking and demand that's apparently increasing.
Yeah, it seems.
The math gets pretty easy.
Yeah.
And it's very easy for tons of folks to digest. And basically now everybody that's ever bought Bitcoin is in the money. Like almost everyone.
Almost everyone, yeah.
And so that leads to, you know, this positive feedback loop of, oh my God, price is up. Why? Because the thesis is really good. So just buy more. Price goes up and you end up in this spiral of a positive feedback loop, and it just ends up sending the price higher. And now you've got the ETF bids to support this price action. And so, you know, I think this is, you know, like Novo said, we are in price discovery mode. And I think you're going to be talking about Bitcoin all-time highs pretty soon, if not within the week, potentially at this rate.
Yeah.
But it has been dramatic. And it is a deeply liquid asset class, and it is now been institutionalized by BlackRock and Fidelity and Invesco and all of these places. And now basically every asset manager on the planet is short upside in this asset because you have no justification for not being somewhat allocated anymore.
Yeah, they used to be able to say, well, we can't go to Coinbase or we can't use a crypto exchange for our clients. But I mean, now, I mean, it's just a ticking clock.
If
I have an advisor, it's so true. If I have an advisor, I'm calling up the phone being like, why aren't we in this, right? And the reality is a lot of them can't get into it yet.
Exactly. And so when those floodgates open, you know, where's the price going to be? So, you know, my price targets for Bitcoin and ETH, you know, through year end are pretty high, north of 100K for Bitcoin. And I'm thinking ETH can get through all-time highs as well, maybe 7,500. 8,000 area.
Wow.
Because the ETF narrative is going to pick up now. And, you know, you're going to have lots of hiccups along the road, 10, 20% corrections here and there.
Yeah.
But the trend is supremely evident.
Yeah, I think in, I don't remember the number in 21, but in 2017, I believe there were 7 20% corrections on the way to all-time high.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a big correction.
Yeah. And given where funding is and OI and leverage, the leverage profile in the crypto complex, you know, you are very susceptible to corrections. At the same time, like, we're running out of sellers.
I know.
There's a lot of buyers of this stuff.
It appears. I mean, I think we continue to be surprised. I mean, at this point now, I'm conditioned to it. But the amount of inflows into these ETFs has been truly stunning.
Staggering.
It took a little while to get going at first. There was a lot of internal capital in the beginning. It seemed a little lackluster for the first week or two. But I mean, now we've been looking, I think 21 of the last 22 days were inflows. And the one that wasn't was like minus like 30 million or something. We're recording on Wednesday. Tuesday, BlackRock's alone had 500 plus. It was their biggest day.
Yeah.
The complex overall, it was the third largest day. And then Monday, the day before, had been the third largest day. So now it's the fourth largest day. Yeah. So it just, the bid has been quite relentless.
Yes. I
guess the question that I've been asking, and I wrote about this a little bit today, was, you know, we've never seen Bitcoin perform at this level at this stage pre-halving. So we're 52 days out from the expected halving date. The prior halving, Bitcoin was down over 60% from its all-time high at this stage pre-halving. Yeah. The one before was about 59%.
No model ETF flows, though. That's the big difference.
Right.
Right? Like, when you combine literally the most innovative financial product we've had in generations with the best capital market ever, right? You get the Bitcoin ETF.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin needs no marketing. You don't need no Super Bowl ads. Everybody already knows about it. And all people need to see is price going up to want to participate. And I'm just sitting here, you know, one, it's kind of shocking where we've come from. I mean, I remember doing these podcasts with that block clock sub 20K.
I remember,
being very depressed.
Really not that long ago,
a year and change, maybe. And, but anyway, the point is the people that haven't caught this, they feel FOMO. The people sitting in lackluster assets like gold, pardon the pun, are probably like, man, am I allocated the wrong fiat to basement hedge right now?
Yeah.
Probably.
I saw an analyst from a major Wall Street research firm this morning on TV straight up saying, like, yeah, you know, with talking macro, nothing about crypto.
Yeah.
And just being like, yeah, for macro hedges, we talk about gold, dollars, and Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And they were like, not treasuries. They were like, no, he said Bitcoin appears to be a much better hedge against fiat debasement.
And this is consistent across most of my macro conversations. Bitcoin is part of that macro narrative now, and it is not going away.
You can't put this back in the box.
The genie is out.
But it has been, just in the last couple of days, it's felt a little bit parabolic, right? It'd be reasonable to see some consolidation or like a near-term correction, right? It's been shocking. I think we're recording, we just hit 64K.
Yeah.
We opened the morning at like in the 58s. It's up. Yeah. It's up $6,000 in one day right now, basically.
Yeah. I think you'd be correct in saying that, you know, some consolidation would be healthy, warranted, etc. However, I just keep thinking about the pools of money that are out there. And when you're talking about fractions of that, would send this thing like well north of 100 even. And so it's just I get it. And when you think about like the short term.
Yeah, what are we supposed to be like, guys, please stop trading and let us catch our breath?
Yeah, please stop. Well, it's like, wait, like this is the ultimate fiat debasement hedge and you don't really have it on for most people.
Put something on.
Yeah, and so it's like, and people's size, like, so here's what happens. It becomes convex in terms of the idea and the feedback loop, but also in terms of the assets it gathers as it gets bigger, because bigger pools of capital can now start engaging in it. When something like IBIT trades $1 billion a day, when the CME futures start to pick up tons of volume, right? And when there's broader acceptance among macro types that it's okay, right? It means that bigger and bigger pools of capital can now actually traffic in it comfortably. From explaining it to their investors, to boards, investment committees, et cetera, to, you know, actually genuinely.
Size. I think you made the point in the past here that as the market cap grows and liquidity deepens, it can actually trade as an actual, like, direct hedge. Not like I'll put on $1 million or $10 million, but like, wait a sec, maybe I want to rotate out of, like, this government debt position into this Bitcoin. And we're talking $1 billion trades and stuff, which it's still a bit too small to, like, you know, point and click on a screen at any moment. But as it gets bigger, that bigger allocations become possible. You made this point a lot.
I mean, it's
I learned this point from you.
Yeah, it was so good at that. And the more big people come in, the more dip buyers there are, and like the higher this thing goes.
I know. What do you think about this? I've been making the point recently that I think that, you know, longtime crypto market observers will know this quite well, that there tends to be this rotational aspect to the crypto market.
Yeah.
December 17, Bitcoin all-time high. January 18, ETH all-time high. March alt season. And that can happen at the total bull run level, but it also happens like in little mini cycles as well. We saw it last fall. But part of my thesis about these ETFs is that they will dampen that intra-crypto rotation trade because the Bitcoin that a lot – so much of the Bitcoin will be in these ETFs. Maybe they're even more so if they're in advisor-managed accounts. They're not sitting on crypto exchanges adjacent to altcoins.
But I'll tell you that you're right on that point, that the wealth of the Bitcoin will stay in these margined accounts.
Yeah.
However, there is a broader wealth effect to these things. And so – you know, everybody that has Bitcoin, like if it's doubled, right, you like a small amount of cash moves alts around a lot.
Yeah.
And so you're definitely going to see the follow-on, like rotations and stuff, now with the ETFs because of just the wealth.
At least
effect.
In repricing at a minimum.
Yes.
If not actual capital flow.
Correct. And you have to also realize that prices get set at the margin. Right. And so you don't need like an insane amount of marginal flow to take some of these like alts.
Especially if you own a bunch of alts and you most likely own some Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And so now you're just like, you're just raising your offer.
Yeah.
You're just like, I'm not selling for.
Yeah, I'm not selling until higher. I don't feel the need to sell.
Yeah. So even if the book's liquidity doesn't deepen from Bitcoin rotational inflows.
Yeah.
Just the bid ask goes higher.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic time to be in crypto.
This is going
to
be a very, I mean, this is, I would say, the first. We've said it, you know, as people who work full-time in this industry several times over the last 6 months, you know, since the Grayscale ruling at the D.C. Circuit of Court of Appeals. But, you know, like, we're back, you know, and it felt like we were back. Today, I think, in my opinion, is the first day where I'm like, wait a second. This feeling.
Coming back.
Yeah, I remember this feeling from the last bull market. I think it's important everybody stay humble.
Yeah,
I think it's important that, look, this is on the back of no FTX, no crypto margined futures is at like its lowest point ever. CME is over 25% of the entire Bitcoin futures market is now cash collateralized CME.
Right?
These guys aren't posting, you know, endogenous exchange tokens as collateral that are highly volatile.
I'm not putting FTT on there to buy Bitcoin.
Exactly. So it's healthier, but I will say, like, you know, it's just things get exciting in a lot of ways. And so, you know, keep your eyes peeled.
It's just nice to have all these institutions, the credibility that comes with this.
Yeah, you're not crazy at all.
I'm not the crazy guy. I'm going to a big conference
in a few minutes. In a few minutes, I'm going to a big conference to talk about the Bitcoin ETFs, and these are major TradFi allocators and investors. So, and it's I'm not an oddity to be invited at this.
No, you might be the most popular guy there today. Showing up in your hoodie and the sneakers.
I'm going to put on a button-down shirt. Yeah. That's the most I'm going to do, though.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Bimnet BB from Galaxy Trading, as always, my friend. Thanks for coming on Galaxy Brains. Let's go now to our guest, SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce. Commissioner, thank you so much for coming on Galaxy Brains.
Alex, it's great to be here. I'm going to start with my commission disclaimer, which is that my views are my own views as a commissioner, not necessarily those of the SEC or my fellow commissioners.
Knowing some of your views, I'm quite certain they're not currently the views of some of the commission. That's partly what we're going to talk about, right?
Well, I mean, I'm ever hopeful.
And constantly pushing, which I really respect. And so our audience, I think, which is mostly professionals in the cryptocurrency ecosystem or investors, I'm sure are well aware of your work in the space, not in the space, in the space of financial regulation, which is actually your space. But it happens to have collided with this innovative new technology and industry. I don't know, broadly at the top, is it a collision? Does it have to be a collision between public blockchains and cryptocurrency networks and specifically securities regulation? That's sort of the world we find ourselves in today. How would you characterize where we are at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think collision is a good way to describe it. You know, anytime you have a new technology come along, it's not surprising that there's going to be some point at which government says, hey, we don't want you to do this. That's not ideal, right? From my perspective, that's not ideal. You want to have a system that really encourages innovation and doesn't require you to jump through a regulatory yes box before you get to innovate. But I think because of the nature of this, that it's started out financial as a financial thing, it's not surprising that it collided with securities regulation.
Yeah, when I think about, I spend a fair amount of time, right? I run research here at Galaxy, and I spend a fair amount of time evaluating various new and evolving regulatory frameworks in other jurisdictions as well. And one of the things one of the ways I've described sort of how this is playing out in various jurisdictions is that there's sort of two approaches that I'm seeing. One is create a brand new bespoke regime, and that's kind of how I would describe what Europe has done with the markets in crypto assets, MiCA framework. And that can work. It's a lot to do, but it's they've come out with something that's, I think, pretty strict and restrictive, but also pragmatically possible. The other approach is to sort of try to squeeze crypto and crypto assets into existing frameworks. And the UK is trying to do that, it looks like. The Treasury has produced all of this work that they've given to the FCA to try to say, here's how we think it could fit. If you do that latter approach, you got to do a lot of work and work with industry and understand how the existing rules could apply. It seems to me that in the United States, the SEC is sort of taking that latter approach. They're saying, well, these are all crypto asset securities, and so they should fall under our existing frameworks, but they haven't done a lot of the work to explain how that could be possible. Is that a fair assessment in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it does fit into the second bucket of saying, yeah, existing regulation works, but it's sort of this existing regulation works. We're not going to tell you how. That's going to be for you to figure out.
Right.
And, I mean, fair enough, right? That's how the securities laws work. They're intended to be principles-based. They're intended to be timeless, right? They're intended to accommodate new things when they come along. I think the issue here is that we haven't really grappled with the fact that there are some new elements here that do require us to do some hard thinking. And, Europe is good at regulation. That's one of their strong suits. And so they did get this regulatory framework done quickly. And we'll get to learn from how effective that framework is and where, you know, maybe it works and where it doesn't work. We didn't have to do something as grand as that. But I think we do have to have conversations with people about, okay, what are we all trying to achieve here? We as securities regulators have a very clear set of regulatory objectives. We know what people are trying to do in the industry. Let's have a conversation about how we can achieve that in a way that everyone's objectives can be met. And we have tools to do that. We have exemptive authority. We can issue no action letters to allow for iterative sort of innovation. Mm-hmm. And so why don't we use those tools? Why don't we sit down and say, hey, we want to make sure that someone buying a token in an ICO gets information. We can figure out how to do that, but let's just all sit around a table and figure it out. And let's try to do that in public so that you don't get one big player sitting in a back room with the SEC, either in a settlement, in an enforcement action, or just, you know, privately trying to come up with regulation.
So having not, it's your view too, and I would agree with this, that we haven't had those discussions enough, right?
I haven't seen it. I mean, I don't understand what the resistance is to just sitting down and having those discussions.
Maybe it's some fear of legitimizing the industry or something merely by talking with it.
Well, and that's a bigger problem, right? I think the idea that the SEC is somehow a stamp of approval, that's never been our role. And we should never suggest to people that it is our role. My mantra is always be skeptical, right? People should be skeptical about everything they're buying, and that includes crypto and includes traditional securities. Ask questions. If you can't figure out what the answers are, then go buy something else.
You mentioned that there are ways for the SEC to encourage disclosure of information, right? Which is a huge part of, maybe I'm a nerd or I'm in a nerdy job, but I spend plenty of time on the Edgar database, and it's filled with disclosures from every securities issuer, every company that is public and files, right? And your safe harbor proposal had a lot to do with this. You, I love, by the way, that you published it on GitHub as well, and which is very interesting and fun. It's great.
Well, it was helpful too, because I got some people saying, hey, this won't work, this will work, right? And getting that feedback.
It's fantastic for change management, basically, for tracking changes, GitHub. But one of the main things that you have in there is token disclosure requirements, disclosures on who invested in it, who, when you might sell it. Yeah. This has been widely talked about. That seems pretty reasonable. In fact, the market is also kind of demanding it from a lot of the big investors in token projects, like venture investors and stuff. Do you think we could ever get something like that absent? In all of the discussion and various, whether it's through enforcements or some of the rulemaking proposals, we're talking about forcing crypto asset securities. I don't know that those exist personally, but into this rule, there hasn't been any discussion about disclosure, really.
Yeah, I mean, because the idea is, okay, well, if it's just a security like any other, then go use the existing
securities.
So then
securities. They would, what, do like 13F but, filings or something?
I think the idea is that, you know, we sort of envision these tiny crypto projects going and doing an ICO-like process. And to me, that's ridiculous. That's not going to happen. So that was sort of the genesis of this safe harbor idea, is come up with a right-sized approach that actually gets people the information they need. Could that happen? I think Congress has been trying to think through what a regulatory regime would look like, who would be the regulators, what disclosure might look like. I think we could have done something like this if we had wanted to years ago, but we chose not to.
It's unfortunate. And I would love to see, let me ask you about this one. What you mentioned in no action letters is one of the authorities that it's a very clear, that is formal guidance, right, when a no action letter?
Well, so a no action letter is a one-off piece of guidance. Technically, sometimes they're used in different ways, but it really is intended to say, you come into us with a set of facts and circumstances, we'll come back. The staff typically, it's typically not the commission, but the staff, will come back to you and say, hey, if you do it just the way you said, then we're not going to recommend an enforcement action to the SEC. But one can see that in this environment, that might be quite valuable.
Right. And I think, maybe wrong, but I think there was only one that was sort of crypto related.
There were a few. But I mean, again, part of my concern even about those new action letters is that on some, you know, do you need to get permission to do something that's clearly outside the securities laws? That also makes me a little nervous, because then it suggests that people have to come to us for permission when they're doing something that is just really unrelated.
I want to use an example, which is that token jet letter, which this is a pretty straightforward question. This is effectively, I remember, I'm going to call it a company, but maybe it's a protocol or something like that, an entity. They want to basically do like a NetJets kind of business, and they want to forward sell seats on these future planes and give you tokens that you can use to pay for those seats, right? You could buy them now and then spend them later. And the commission said a couple things, but the primary ones I think that are most relevant is this is totally fine if the tokens are effectively like airline points. They have to maintain a stable value, and they can't trade on a secondary market. And I guess in that case, I think TokenJet said, great, like that's how we're going to run it. Kind of like an airline's points program.
That's the example where I'm thinking, do they really have to come to the SEC and get permission to do something like that?
Right.
And, you know, usually there's negotiation around what those conditions are.
Right.
But maybe
there was some that led to that. One thing that's so interesting is now, so I think a lot of what I'm seeing in the, I'll call it the market, but in the global cryptocurrency ecosystem is they say, oh, okay, well, if we give out points instead of tokens and we don't let you transfer them, those aren't securities, according to the SEC.
And people certainly do, in crypto or not, people look to no action letters and say, okay, these are lines that the SEC draws. And that's understandable.
Yeah.
But you do have to be careful, because they really are facts and circumstances based.
So let's talk a little bit about just Howie and the unregistered securities question, right? This has been, you've written many very eloquent dissents on a variety of times, usually in dissenting to an enforcement action taken against, say, Library was one, LBRY. But like we'll say it, an early token project that did some kind of token generation event, raised money that way, and was later brought an enforcement, the SEC brought against them for having conducted an unregistered securities offering. This has happened a number of times, as you know. I think it's the primary way I would say that the SEC has engaged in the crypto world has been by bringing enforcements for unregistered securities offerings. What is the view now? I think our audience will know pretty well. We've heard the chairman of the commission and others, and we've watched some of these have gone to court, and we've watched the SEC's arguments in those court cases. How would you characterize the SEC's current, the commission's current view of how Howie applies to cryptocurrencies.
Well, I'm going to go back to my disclaimer and
yes.
tell you that my views are sometimes very different, right? And so they're certainly not representative of the commission. And I don't want to characterize the commission's view except to say that I think we have been legally imprecise. And that's something that I think if we had started out, and I fault myself for this too, if we had started out with greater legal precision around what we were talking about here, I think we would be in a better place. Because the Howie test, as everyone in crypto now knows, comes out of an Orange Grove case where the Orange Grove came along with a contract that the person who sold it would maintain this for you and you wouldn't have to do anything, right? So this is, buyer is getting this thing, efforts of others, just sit back and the profits will come to you. Mm-hmm. And so the point of that is that you can have anything at the center of an investment contract, any kind of thing. It can be a chinchilla or it can be an orange grove, or it could be a crypto asset. But the question then becomes, how long does that crypto asset drag along with it, that investment mm-hmm. contract? And I just think a lot of the reasoning in this space has been a bit messy and undefined. And that's what I'd like us to do, is sit down and think about what we're actually trying to achieve here.
When people, and I've seen, again, I'm not asking you to comment on the specifics of any of these cases, but I've seen some criticism of the current commission's view of Howie, that it lacks a limiting principle. Is that what you're talking about? Like, how long does it get pulled along? Is that?
Yeah, well, it lacks a limiting principle in terms of, you know, what are we pointing at to find that investment contract in the first place?
Right.
And then it lacks a limiting principle in the sense of how long does it, you know, does it carry along whatever this investment contract is? So I just think it's kind of, you know, if you're building a blockchain project, probably when you're selling the tokens, you're not going to say this thing is going to be terrible and it's never going to work. You're going to say, hey, we're building this new blockchain and this is what the plans are. And that's understandable, right? That's what you would expect. So.
Right.
I just think we have to be careful in figuring out what it is the securities laws should cover and what they shouldn't cover. And so that's where I think we still have work to do.
It's so tricky I get there really is a collision to go back because
yes.
this is global decentralized software development. And if we just take Bitcoin as an example, like or Ether, either one, or frankly, like you can even use a generic blockchain, many Layer 1 blockchains effectively require a native asset in order to incentivize good behavior on the chain. For example, to prevent spam, you have to pay some kind of fee. It's a classic mechanism for preventing spam is to require some cost, right? And that is sort of immediately leads to the creation of an asset. So then the question is, well, how does the asset come into existence, right?
Right.
Satoshi mined it him or their self a lot at first, but never really transacted.
I actually saw Satoshi the other day driving down the highway.
Did you really?
License plate Satoshi.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't want to say too much because I know some people that have that plate. So you may have seen
maybe,
a friend of
maybe
mine.
Maybe it was. Yeah.
So you have proof of work, for example, is seen as a good distribution method because anyone can show up and perform that work and get tokens. But it's hard to get the tokens out. It can be. Even that's difficult. I mean, we've been mining Bitcoin for 15 years. It's not all distributed, right? Is that sort of where this happens? If there was some way, and obviously, so I bring this up, sorry, I bring this up because there are so many ways to get them out. And each time that the SEC has, for example, they had the ICO era, we call mm-hmm. it, right? And these in some ways look like public offerings, certainly, right? They sold them to the public in many cases. And then that became understood to be, at a minimum, put you at risk of receiving enforcement actions from the SEC. So started having these private offerings, right? And then the market has sort of said, well, we don't really love what ends up coming out of those. So now we're currently in this big era of airdropping, right? Where you say, well, if you use something that exists already, we'll give our token to the people that already use that thing. And I mentioned the points before because this is something people have been doing. And they're saying, well, they're probably not a security because according to that no action letter, they're not transferable and they're not... but now what's happening, because these are global, composable, open software platforms, while some other people, not the creator of the points, they've come around and said, we've got a way for you to transfer your points. So it's almost like life finds a way, right? It's like water on pavement. And to me, that's been what's most disappointing about the the commission's approach to not having a, I mean, if water is going to spill, you got to dig a trench for it to go into. Otherwise, it spills all over the place. And it's, crypto globally has proven so creative that I don't think this will work.
No, I think you're right. We need to think about what people are trying to accomplish. We need to find a way to allow, I mean, the good stuff, right? There are a lot of people, sure, who just went out there to sell crypto assets to just steal money. And
oh,
that's
totally
a whole different
set of. There have been
plenty of those. Yeah. So,
we don't like those.
So those, we'll put those to the side. But for people who, I don't want people who are actually trying to build a new blockchain to have to think a lot about how they have to do this in order to comply with rules. It should be pretty clear how they can comply with the rules and still do something. So that's where I think we've made it a lot harder than it has to be.
Let me ask you about some, like, of the other sort of non-Howey things that happened. So SEC regulates a variety of players in financial services, one of whom, of course, is exchanges. So national securities exchanges are regulated by the SEC, right? It's power, I believe. I'm not a lawyer, so this is not legal advice. It's born out of the Exchange Act primarily, right? And there's a proposal, a proposed rulemaking to expand the definition of exchange, or the SEC's interpretation of that, I should say. So not new legislative statutory authority, but new guidance, new rulemaking, I guess, is it rulemaking?
It's a rulemaking.
So it's it changes the interpretation the SEC has of what the word exchange means, and it expanded it a lot. It said they added communications protocol network, or I believe.
System,
mm-hmm. Thank you. Computer, which is, by the way, that sounded very vague, very general, right? And so a lot of people wrote into the first comment period saying, are you referring to blockchains? And does this cover decentralized finance? And in the reopening of the comment period, the commission wrote at length.
Yes.
Absolutely, yes, that's what
yes.
we mean. You've written, and I think I listened to a meeting that the commission had where you spoke critically of this. What's your view on that?
Well, so it is still open, right? We haven't moved to adoption yet. And we have gotten a lot of negative comments on that. I wondered when the first iteration came out, because it was so broadly written, I wondered what it meant for crypto. And so I think it's good that we now have some clarity on what it means. Now, the clarity itself is not, in my view, good. And obviously, we're still considering comments and all that. But the concern that I have is that it's a very broad definition. And as it applies to decentralized things, very, very confusing. To me, the message it seems to send is you're going to have to centralize so we can regulate you, or you're going to have to get out of the U.S., or you could just shut down if you'd prefer. So you've got three options, all of which are bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're talking about something that's decentralized, the question is, okay, who are you going to ask to register? The developers? Well, that's problematic, right? Or is it anyone who uses it? That's problematic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so this is an area where I think everyone needs to do some really serious thinking. And I mean, you know, look, regulators are always going to look for a centralized entity to regulate. That's just what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But the answer can't be that peer-to-peer or peer-to-protocol transactions are illegal in the U.S. That can't be the right answer.
And that does feel like the de facto result of this, because if there is a truly decentralized application, and there are, they can't reasonably comply.
Because, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how that could work. And when I ask those questions, like, well, who do you want to register? We just had a new rule that dealt with dealers, which we just adopted.
Right.
And, you know, the question is, well, okay, who you say automated market makers are pulled into this. All right, who do you want to register?
Right. Yeah, there was a question of, there was some threshold there, I think, which
there's a threshold, yeah. And so everyone says, okay, well, it's
I don't have $50
million,
so I
don't
safe,
care,
but,
right?
But some do, by the way.
But and the point I would make there is, fine, you don't have that now. They can change the threshold tomorrow and
right.
drop it. And
right.
so we have to understand how these things will work.
If it's structurally impossible for the targeted entity
right.
to comply, is that bad regulation by definition?
I think if you as a regulator don't think about that beforehand, you have a real problem.
Right. It's kind of like you're living in you're living in an alternate reality if you
right.
Or legislate. Legislation too, by the way, same idea. If it creates an illegal prohibition and it can't ever really be enforced, it's just bad law in my view.
It is, and I think this is a moment where we as a nation really need to sit down and think about what we're doing, because we could end up prohibiting things that are really problematic to prohibit. So we better be very careful, because I think a lot of rules are going to be made and are being made that could have really adverse effects.
I like that you said careful. This was the conclusion of a speech you gave in Texas at the Texas Blockchain Council, shout out TBC, called Lawless in Austin. It's a great speech. I encourage it was a quite poetic speech. You were comparing, people had said that crypto is the Wild West. You said, well, let's talk about the Wild West and what it was. And it was dangerous, and there were, but it was also the frontier. It was pushing the envelope, right? It was massive opportunity. And you suggested at the end that, like, the, you know, a path forward here for regulators should be to tread carefully. That, I think you gave that speech in October or fall 2021, I'll say. I forget which month. So it's been over 2 years since then.
A lot of bad things have happened since
then.
Yeah,
I was going to ask you, how would you rate the regulators broadly, or however you want to answer this? Did they tread carefully? What is their...
Well, a lot of bad things have happened in the crypto markets too, right?
That's
a lot
true.
Of bad things have come out. And so, you know, I think someone could ask me, hey, do you still stand by that speech? And I do stand by that speech. We are a risk-taking society. That's kind of in our DNA. That doesn't mean that everyone has to take risks on everything, but I think it should mean that the government doesn't tell you you can't take risks. Have regulators been careful? I don't think so. I mean, I think creating regulatory uncertainty, perpetuating that regulatory uncertainty is not careful. And I think it actually has led to more people being hurt than otherwise would have been if we had had clearer lines of where things fall. And I think the industry obviously has learned a lot too, right? There's some lessons that when you travel out to the frontier, you don't forget to take with you,
right.
You know, the sort of common sense lessons that you learned in the more traditional society. So I think that those lessons have been hammered home quite painfully.
Oh, yes, they have. It's been a very tumultuous time. I do think it's fair to say that if there had been clearer regulatory framework for crypto, then maybe some of them wouldn't have happened, actually.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah. Can I ask you about the Bitcoin ETFs?
Sure.
And I'm not going to ask for, I mean, it was, what an exciting time. I've been following this for, I mean, for 10 years. I recall when the Winklevoss, Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss filed for the first ETF proposal. It was 10 years ago. It took that long. Should it have taken that long?
No, I mean, I started at the SEC in January 2018. I think the denial of the Winklevoss ETP was that summer. And so that was when I wrote my first dissent I thought we should have approved back then or let it go forward back then. I would never have believed it would take this long. But I actually think the excitement, that depresses me too. And here's why. Because all that buildup, right, from the time I started at the SEC, one of the first questions I would get was, when Bitcoin ETP, when is it coming? And all that excitement, building, building, building. And then, you know, you have too much excitement around something. It's sort of unfortunate, I think. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be part of the drama, and we became part of the drama.
Absolutely. As a market commentator, I spent most of the last 6 months discussing the likelihood, the potential impact, et cetera, whereas it really should be a pretty vanilla kind of question, right? I mean, and by the way, doesn't it protect investors more if they can access exposure to some asset through the traditional mechanisms we have, right? Through the BlackRock's, Fidelity's, Invesco's, as opposed to, you know, maybe offshore dangerous startups, right? I mean, doesn't that bring it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that product has proved to be one that, regardless of what the underlying is, has been one that investors like to use. And there were other products that were out there that were more expensive for investors. I think it's important, again, to say the SEC is not advocating that anyone buy any product. That is never what we do. Just because it's in an exchange-traded product wrapper doesn't mean the SEC is signing off on
right.
it. But that's, again, a fundamental problem with how the SEC has marketed itself, right? We have to be—well, I don't know that we've marketed ourselves that way, to be fair, but— how people look at the SEC.
Right.
You should never look to the government to make your investment decisions for you.
I think it's timeless advice. Regarding that process, there was a, I mean, I was not just following the likelihood, I was reading all of the updated, the amended S1s and anything else that was published, as many other observers were. One of the big changes that happened before the commission ultimately voted to allow them was the removal of in-kind creations and redemptions. So the idea that you could bring Bitcoin directly to the fund or take Bitcoin out of the fund. Can you say anything about what that debate was and why we've ended up now with only cash create and redeem?
I mean, I can't really say what led us to that place. I can say I am somewhat concerned that that feature is something new, and I don't know what new risks that feature brings. So I personally have some concerns around that limitation.
Around not having in-kind create?
Right.
Yeah. I think that's fair. I think you've seen a lot of a lot was written, I saw, and filed.
And again,
by,
I'm not trying to cast, you know, aspersions on any product. I'm just saying that is a feature that leads to some unknowns for me.
Yeah, that makes sense. I want to shift gears a little bit and ask about banks and broker-dealers, one of my favorite topics. So one, actually, I guess it's connected, because one speculation here was that, well, broker-dealers have a very difficult time touching crypto assets today. And, well, maybe that's why broker-dealers, many of the largest authorized participants that work with ETF issuers across asset classes are broker-dealers. And if it was create, redeem in kind, maybe they wouldn't be able to. But without discussing that specifically with the create, redeem, in general, broker-dealers seem to be mostly left out of the party here because of the restrictive or the lack of guidance even from the SEC. Is that something that needs to change for any purpose at all? I mean, crypto seems to be doing okay, by the way. So it's more, in my mind, about does the SEC want to let traditional finance be involved in this burgeoning asset class?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to ask those questions. There are some difficult issues around crypto and broker-dealers. Broker-dealers are covered by SIPC, which is an insurance sort of program, and it covers cash and securities. The question is, where is crypto fit in? And I think those are fair questions, right? Those are the kinds of conversations that we should be having to figure that out. But, you know, we have a special purpose broker-dealer regime now. Well, we've had it for a while, but one of the criteria is you're limited to digital asset securities, right? So that means no Bitcoin. And so it does lead to some difficulties in terms of...
Yeah.
And so I think your point about cash versus in-kind and how broker-dealer authorized participants would be able to deal with in-kind is a fair question.
Yeah.
So even if the, you know, even if the product were designed differently, I think that would be an issue.
Yeah, it's very interesting to watch because it's not like gold. I mean, in-kind create redeem with like a gold ETF. Well, I mean, gold is physically heavy. Like, I don't know. Would we be having Brinks trucks driving up like the street to drop off gold or take it out of the ETF? But to me, just like technologically speaking, like Bitcoin is weightless. It's digital. It's quite easy to send and receive. That's basically, it's almost easier to send and receive than any asset ever created, almost, to be honest.
That's part of its allure, I think, right?
Right. And so it just seems like a no-brainer that should be allowed. But I have some sympathy, too. I mean, it is different, though. And so, but it seemed like there was a lot of work that had been done to educate the commission and the various parties.
Yeah, I mean, look, these products have been trading in other jurisdictions for a very long time.
Right.
And so we had that experience, too. They traded through a lot of very, you know, ups and downs in the market, stresses. And so we could have taken some comfort from those other markets as well. But, you know, certainly education, court decision, things moved us along.
Yeah. On banks, there was a staff accounting bulletin, SAB 121, as it's known. And maybe you can give me some, like, institutional knowledge on where that actually comes from at the SEC, first of all. But my understanding is that it requires public companies to carry the end client assets, crypto assets that they may hold, as liabilities on their own balance sheet. So this would include any publicly traded bank, for example. But because banks separately also have capital requirement rules, they would have to hold, like, an equal amount of dollars to match those liabilities. The combination of these two things, this accounting bulletin and their bank capital requirements, have made it according to the banks themselves, impossible for them to custody digital assets. Where does that come from? First of all, SAB 121, is that a rule? What is that?
Well, so it's a staff accounting bulletin, which means it's put out by the staff of the Office of Chief Accountant. And it came as an unpleasant surprise to me. And when it first came out, you know, I'm not an accountant, so I'm trying to figure out what does this actually mean. I think the big issue is that it came out without putting it out for notice and comment. And a second issue is that it reads to me to be part of the larger campaign to prevent traditional entities, regulated entities, entities with experience in custody, to keep them away from anything related to crypto. So we see that too with accounting firms, you know, sort of dissuading them from being involved. People wonder, you know, it's really hard to find a bank that will serve you if you're a crypto company. Why is that a wise thing to say, we want all the established players in this space not to participate? So that, I think, is my biggest complaint about SAB 121, is that it sort of perpetuates that problem. A lot of people have said it just doesn't make any sense, right? Because it, for the reasons that you raised, it really is unworkable. We were told that it should have gone to Congress for approval, so now there's a lot of attention on it from Congress.
Right.
But it's still out there. We haven't pulled it back, so it's unfortunate.
The Congress appears to believe that, well, elements in Congress, I should say, that it is objectively a rule.
Well, it's a Government Accountability Office finding that it's a rule for a narrow purpose.
Right, the purpose of the Congressional Review Act, which would let Congress, I guess, overturn it,
exactly.
So in any case, there's demonstrated dispute about whether this is a good thing. It's not just—
And then it's being applied more broadly, too, which is another odd— It's supposed to only apply to public companies. It seems to be being applied more broadly.
Oh, wow.
It needs some public discussion to figure out what the right approach is here. And that's, I think it's unfortunate, again, that we've taken this, that we've allowed the staff just to put this out, and that it's out there and it's governing quite a bit of what people can and can't do.
So this office, do they provide guidance to the accounting firms? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I can see. So it has a sort of a chilling effect. It's sort of like, well, if you don't account for these assets this way for your clients, you're contravening this guidance from—
Well, and it also applies to the companies, right? The Office of Chief Accountant is the top accountants at the SEC. So yes, it provides guidance to accounting firms, but public companies, you know, it specifically applies to public companies.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's staff guidance, right? So, technically, you don't have to comply with it.
Well, right.
But it's written, if you read how it's written very much like a rule.
It did. It seems very proscriptive, the language.
Yes.
I loved your point about the effect of it, because there, for example, I'm not going to name them just for courtesy, but there are big banks, for example, custody banks, custody trusts, or trust companies, I should say, that custody trillions of dollars. And they've been doing it great. In some cases, I'll shout one out here, Bank of New York, which was founded by Alexander Hamilton hundreds of years ago, has been successfully safeguarding client assets of all types for centuries. But a rule like this makes it... And so then you say, well, where does it push the user? Why can't I go to the literal oldest bank in the country, founded by one of America's most storied founding fathers, to custody this, in the case of Bitcoin, private key material? It's not even a... It's barely even a thing. It's some letters and numbers. And that, so pointing that out, I think, is great, because it pushes users into, I don't know, newer, sort of different types of places, which aren't necessarily bad, but are certainly not those storied
institutions. Yeah, and again, it's great to have new competition come in, too, but why would you want to shut off a whole area? It's sort of the whole, another thing that bothers me is when you look at, exchanges doing proof of reserves, for example, is it the same thing as a full audit? No, but as long as you don't say that's what it is, as long as you're honest about what it is, what the limitations are, why wouldn't we want to encourage more transparency? Why wouldn't we want to encourage experimentation with ways to show people, yes, the crypto assets are actually here.
Right.
It seems like we should be happy about market efforts to try to provide better transparency, to provide protections to prevent some of the bad things happening that we saw happen. And that's what's discouraging to me. If you just push it all outside of the traditional mechanisms that we've used for everything else, and then you say, ha, look, it's all outside the traditional mechanisms for what we use for everything else. Well, yeah, obviously, because you pushed it there. Again, another unfortunate regulatory phenomenon right now.
Yeah, one of the other outcomes was that, okay, so you're not a bank, but you're a public company. And this was a headline that Coinbase, obviously, is a public company and a large holder of client assets. And when SAB 121 came out, they had to disclose that, by the way, technically speaking, your assets, which we're saying that we're custodying, you know, I know there's dispute about the word custody theoretically, but which we're holding on your behalf, they're now actually carried on our balance sheet. Now, they don't have bank holding capital requirements, so they're not prohibited sort of pragmatically the way maybe the big banks are now complaining they are. But they had to say, well, technically in the case of a bankruptcy, this kind of reduces the remoteness, the bankruptcy remoteness of it. So it's just all so bad that there it actually harms users theoretically, right?
Well, you do want to make sure that people know what is going to happen if there's a bankruptcy.
Totally.
And I think that would be a better place for us to spend our efforts, is making that very clear and making sure that market participants are making it clear to retail customers what mm-hmm. would happen if the entity goes down. That would be a much better use of our time.
Yeah. Can I ask you about just broadly tokenization, or the idea that equities themselves, maybe single stocks even, might one day trade on a blockchain or be custodied as a digital asset token? This is something I was at Fidelity for 12 years before I came to Galaxy, and I was at one point in that career as director of blockchain research, and this was something that we looked at extensively. There's got to be a way we can take the main parts of our business and somehow get efficiencies or enhancement or innovation from blockchains, but we haven't seen it yet. Is there been any work done at the commission that you've seen, or that you're, or are you interested in this? Do you think there's a future where this is very viable? Just sort of your thoughts on, because it's kind of coming up again now. It's a big discussion in 15, mm-hmm. 16. A lot of people said, well, we don't really like Bitcoin, but blockchains, we love, the blockchains are going to be great. I call it the blockchain, not Bitcoin era. Yeah. We're kind of seeing a resurgence of that, and I think rightly so, because blockchains are a very powerful technology. There's got to be a way that they could be additive, but what are your thoughts on this topic in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think equity securities, I think fixed income securities, I can see tokenization being valuable for both. You know, we're seeing some of that with tokenized money market funds, things like that. But why hasn't this happened sooner? I would argue it's because if you have a regulatory environment in which you don't encourage that kind of experimentation to see where does this make sense and where doesn't it make sense. We all might have ideas of things, you know, why it might make sense. So let's let that play out. But we have created an environment where no one wants to come in and say to the SEC, hey, I have an experiment I want to run. This is what I'm planning to do. I know this is a highly regulated area, so let's figure out how we can run this experiment. There's been a little bit of that, again, tokenized money market funds being one of those, but I think there would have been much more if we had had more open doors. And so, you know, I fear all that will happen outside the U.S.
It definitely is starting to happen outside the U.S., and I did something like 40 or 50% of venture investment in the crypto blockchain sector is still going to U.S. headquartered companies, but it's declining, that percentage, of quarter over quarter. I've been following this since that data set, since 2018. So we're still in that position.
Yeah.
I do fear we might lose it. And this is a little bit related here. You know, I guess they call the SEC's mission a tripartite mission, mm-hmm. right? And it's, correct me if I always forget one of them. I'm going to remember
protecting investors, facilitating capital formation, and basically protecting fair, orderly, and efficient markets. Market integrity is the third.
Right. So Robert Jackson wrote that there was a fourth pillar, an unknown fourth pillar, and I think this was maybe in 2018, competition. I sort of read that and thought it sounded a lot like innovation, too, what he was saying. But I don't know, is kind of running through a lot of what you write about and talk about, is this idea that at a minimum, the commission's got to be more open to innovation and competition. But is that, I know it's not a statutory one, but is that fair, characterizing your view correctly?
Well, I mean, I think competition should be a given, right? In this country, we should want to have a landscape that allows existing entrants to fail and go away and allows new entrants to come in. And you don't need a regulatory permission slip. I mean, for some things, right, we have a statutory framework that requires some steps to, before you can enter into the traditional financial system. But we should keep those barriers to entry low. And we should be enthusiastic about new entrants coming in to shake things up a little bit, to challenge the way things are being done. The problem is that regulators get used to dealing with a few large firms and, you know, especially in an area like this where you have people who are coming really from outside the financial industry, it's hard, right? It's hard to figure out how to deal with this new set of market participants. But I think if you want to keep a dynamic industry, you've got to be welcoming to that. And again, the message has to be, yeah, you can come in and play, but if you fail, that's your problem. It's not mine, right? That's, you know, this is the way to keep things dynamic, is to, everyone should be a little bit on watch all the time that some competitor is coming from behind to overtake them. And that's the system that I think is the best one for the retail investor, is always to have people fighting for her money, right? Mm-hmm. Always to have people fighting to provide services to her.
It's a very free market view, which I also agree with. And it's maybe perhaps a good segue to really, I think, about, we're almost out of time. So, you know, this view is very rooted in the idea of a free and competitive open market. You obviously don't believe there should be no rules. How would you characterize your, but again, you're articulating a much more dynamic, competitive market, I think, than the commission is proposing or creating in crypto in America today. But I think that is inherently quite American. It certainly goes back, and it's certainly much more competitive and free and innovative than other jurisdictions. How would you characterize your view of free markets, or just broadly the role of government in economies?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a commissioner at the SEC, and we have a set of statutes that govern what we do and don't do. But they do, I think, taking that as the baseline, then I think, okay, what is the approach that we should take when we think about new regulation? And my approach is always, we need to be very careful, going back to this theme of care, before we put in a new regulation. Because what is a regulation? A regulation is saying that two people, maybe companies, but maybe individual people, cannot engage in a transaction unless they do it according to this set of rules that the government has set out. So that means you're overriding the free will of two people, presuming that both people are adults and capable of making decisions, right? Mm-hmm. Then I think it should take a lot before I jump into the middle of that transaction and say, wait a minute, I'm going to tell you guys how you have to do this transaction. Mm-hmm. That is sort of the core of who we are as an American people, is that we respect one another's rights to make decisions which we might not make for ourselves, which might be very different than what we think is right. But as long as you're doing something that's not hurting someone else, you should be free to make those decisions. So I certainly approach it from the view of the government is there to play a limited role in placing a regulatory framework around things, but then to stand back and let people make their own individual decisions. And I think that respects human dignity, right? At the end of the day, it doesn't respect human dignity if I come in and say, well, I'm a regulator, and so even though you're living your life, you know your circumstances better than I do, you know your challenges, you know your strengths, you have a much better sense of what your future is going to be than I do, I'm going to come in and I'm going to make that decision for you. It's a very infantilizing approach. And so, yes, I certainly come to it from the perspective of place for a regulation, but that place needs to be bounded. Mm-hmm. And the other part that we often forget is that markets don't always work, but governments don't always work either. Government solutions almost always carry with them baggage that could that can harm people. And so the assumption that just because market sometimes messes up, which markets do, that the government is going to pile it in with exactly the right solution, it's just that's just not realistic. I've been in government long enough to know that is not realistic.
SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce, thank you so much for coming on Galaxy Brains and talking with us.
Thanks, Alex.
That's it for this week's episode of Galaxy Brains. Thank you to our guest, SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce, and her team, and my friend Tyler Williams from Galaxy for helping make that interview happen. And to our friend Bim Medabibi from Galaxy Trading, as always. A lot going on in this market. Everybody, hang on tight, stay humble, and keep safe. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to Galaxy Brains, the weekly podcast from Galaxy Research. If you enjoy the show, please like, rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. To follow Galaxy Research, sign up for our weekly newsletter at gdr.email, read our content at galaxy.com/research, and follow us on Twitter at GLXY Research. See you next week.